wasn't Larry Murray. Never mind.
You don't mean, it wasn't... You meant Glenn Old?
No, way before he came.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Yeah. I just kind of think who that would be.
Well, the reason I said that is that there was some feeling. I've talked to both Ward and Dorothy, who retains a certain amount of bitterness, that there had been a promise that the land would be used as a liberal act for liberal arts galleries. They had that impression. And the architects were, there was some dispute about the architects. They were changed. I mean, Ward had Clark and Rapuano as his preference, and then they were ousted, and Valen's architects, this is Voorhees, Walker, Smith, and Haynes came in. And as I understand it, they were actually censured by the American Institute of Architects for the way in which that happened.
Yeah, right. That's very unprofessional.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Elwin Stevens can...
He can probably...
I think you ought to talk to Elwin Stevens about that.
All right.
Because I think I'm sure he would have a much more detailed and clearer memory of that than I do, because he would have certainly had been involved with it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't that directly involved with it.
Okay. Well, let's see.
But I would have thought that most of the negotiations are... I don't know whether John Slocum, you know, who later on...
Slocum.
Became secretary to the Board of Trustees after Larry Murray left that job. It might have been John Slocum.
I think it was John Slocum.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
Do you know where he is?
Oh, yeah. He lives in Hollowville.
Where?
Hollowville? Columbia County.
Okay.
Martha Downey would probably, I don't have it with me, but I mean, that's where he lives, in Hollowville.
I see, all right.
That's in Columbia County. It's down near Kinderhook.
Yeah.
He was,
I think that was that one.
He's retired now. After he left the university, he went into teaching.
Okay. Do you want to just read each one of these and comment?
Okay.
Where you have.
Well, that was the Blagan report. There wasn't any Blaney report.
I see. All right.
It was the Blagan report.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you understand why the Long Island Center look at it as part of the gift, because they were able to get it as a gift. Well, Leonard Olson was selected to head it because he had been brought in when he came from the University of Chicago and was a friend of, an acquaintance of Reuben Froden.
Reuben who?
Froden.
F-R-O-D-I-N.
Who was the first executive dean in charge of graduate and professional education. And Stu Gordon who later became president of Binghamton, and before that dean at Harper College, where under Feil, when he left to go there, Leonard Olson came into central administration.
I see.
And worked with Froden.
I see.
And then when Froden was fired,
he fired him. In other words, did Carlson, did Froden come in with Carlson?
Well, no, he was there before Carlson. But Froden, Carlson fired Froden because Froden refused to do what he was supposed to do. I mean, I can remember the particular incident involved. We had a meeting in relation with the Finance Committee of the Board of Trustees in New York, and he was supposed to be there to present the budgetary recommendations and program recommendations to them for the four-year and professional liberal arts and professional colleges. That was primarily the contract colleges, and he didn't come. And just, he was just out shopping. He was just thumbing his nose at Carlson. So, and of course the trustees were very much upset by his cavalier behavior, so anyway, Carlson called him in and asked, so Froden offered his resignation, but he didn't think Carlson was going to accept it, but he did, he accepted it in fact. So, but in a sense, well, Len Olson was his assistant at that point, and he was the logical person from central administration to head a development of get started with the development of a program on Long Island.
Why logical?
Hmm?
He didn't have a PhD.
Well, in this sense, he had been involved in working in that area with Froden.
I see.
And Froden wasn't there anymore.
I see. Somebody had to take.
Somebody had to fill in. And he was the one that knew most about it. So he was the one that was available.
Well, they gave him, I think, less than 6 months to start the darn thing, didn't they?
Right, yes, yes. Yeah, it was a tough assignment. But he was a hard worker, I'll say that for him. I didn't always, people could object to him in a lot of ways, but he was a hard worker, and he had a pretty good vision of what a quality higher education institution required. In curriculum and personnel.
Yeah. Well, it went there before the gift of land to Ward Melville, by Ward Melville.
Mm-hmm.
And that must have followed fairly shortly. Okay. Let's see. How was the Heal report received by the trustees, and how is it, what happened, how was it implemented?
I would have to say, and this is just my recollection of it, I think they were disappointed in the Hill report,
mm-hmm.
in that they felt it was rather superficial, and that it didn't really make very specific recommendations. It was a very generalized kind of report. I think they felt it was in the right direction, you know, but not something that really gave them the kind of a recommendations they would hope to build a master plan from, and you know, a comprehensive program from.
Did you see anything of Tipton?
Who?
Tipton.
Yes, well, Tipton, yes, right. Now,
forgot his first name.
Yes, he was, he's a very, very, he was an extremely able person, and he was much more, I think he was a lot more knowledgeable, in particular about public higher education than Heald was. And he'd had a lot of experience nationally and a great deal of it in relation to public higher education in state universities, and particularly in the Midwest. And
was Heald ever connected with the Ford Foundation?
I think he may well have been, but I can't verify that. I think he might well have been a member of the board of the Ford Foundation. I think he might well have been. Of course, that's where Froden, of course, went when he left.
That's right.
Froden was, he went to work for the Ford Foundation. And Al Yerrick, of course, went to work for the Ford Foundation as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, Froden originally was recruited by Yerrick.
Is Al Yerrick still living?
Yes. Yeah. He lives in Connecticut.
He lives in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. And his second wife, they both live there. They have a nice place in Connecticut. And she was at one time in a place in the Bassett.
Oh, really?
What
was her name?
Nell Hutchison. Because she was married. She first knew Al Yerrick when he was teaching at the University of Minnesota. And she was a student of his. And she was always enamored of him. And when he came to State University, he brought her to work for State University on public relations. At that time, she was married to a man who was in the had an executive job at some publishing house in New York City. When Yerrick's wife divorced him, then he and Mel became quite close. Ultimately, they married.
Mm-hmm. You know what town?
And she was first, the first job she had was out in that women's college in St. Louis.
Stevens?
Yeah.
It's in Columbia, but yeah, I think. But,
huh?
But Stevens is a women's college in Missouri.
Yeah, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. That was it. Then later on, she came back to New York and took this job on at Basque. Mm-hmm. And then she commuted back and forth from their home in Connecticut. And Al commuted back and forth to the Ford Foundation. And then later on, he set up his own consulting business in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know where they live in Connecticut?
No,
I can find...
I don't know them. I don't know where they live. But it's not too far from the New York State border. Mm. It has to be fairly close.
Sure.
Because both he commuted to New York and she commuted to Poughkeepsie. Mm.
Okay. All right.
I wouldn't say the concept of the master plan stemmed from the recommendations of the Hill Report, no.
They had a concept of the master plan before the Hill Report.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Right.
They talk about the first master plan as being 1960.
Well, that's true. They had been working on it, though. However, you see, you couldn't really have the first master plan until you had state education law changed and amended. And I've forgotten exactly what year that amendment took place. And that was it was somewhat before 60, but it required in that legislation, it required that State University would develop a master plan subject to the approval of the regents and the governor. And I would say it was probably that legislation probably was in 57 or 58, sometime along that time. And then it gave a couple of years or so before the first master plan would be presented.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I think you've handled 11, 12. What do you know about what went on in Oyster Bay? It's item 12.
Well?
And how much did the central office know in the past?
I would have to say that they probably didn't know as much as they would like to, and what they did know, they didn't like. I think they were quite disturbed about the situation.
See, I came in September of 62, which was the day, or it was the time that they were moving out to Stony Brook.
Yeah.
So everything I know about Oyster Bay is second or third hand.
Well, you probably know more about it than I do, but I do remember. That's it was a kind of a sore spot. But which you could understand, you know, I think, because,
As I understand it, Lee took the master, took the Hill Report as as the blueprint for the future.
Yeah.
And then tried to implement it in a rather tactless way.
Right. Well, I think that was probably right. I don't think that the trustees were not acceptive of the Hill Report so much as, but I think they were concerned about the tactless way that Olson operated. But I can't remember the details of that.
Okay.
Other than that.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's 12 and 13. You know, I dealt with Harry Porter, and I came up periodically and met with Collins and Anderson from Buffalo, and I guess it must have been Gordon. From Binghamton. And we would talk back and forth about who would do what institution would do this or that, and what the concept was of the task of the four institutions.
Of the what?
The task of the four university centers.
Right.
When I came in, the students were anti-administration, and the faculty was split down the middle between supporters of Lee and supporters of Olson. And I think it was fortunate that they shifted campuses out to Stony Brook, because it immediately dispersed people physically, and it was obviously a growing situation, and you had to look ahead and try to put things behind you. And I think I was able to get the discord.
Yeah, well, those were hard days with administration and students.
And the
I think that probably bothered Belleville more than anything was the attitude of students that existed in that period. But that wasn't peculiar to Stony Brook or Buffalo or Binghamton or Albany.
Well, this was before 68. This was before our bust.
Right. But all through the 60s, the students were quite rebellious.
Well, I was told later by our dean of students that one thing I did more to reconcile the students and the administration than anything else, and that was the letter or notice or memorandum that I put out at the time of the assassination of Kennedy. I tried to speak for everybody, Americans, students, everybody else, about that. Apparently I did a good job on it. And the students felt somebody understood.
Yeah.
But that helped.
Yeah.
We had Charlie Cooper as business manager at the time.
Right.
He was extremely helpful.
Yeah, that was a tough job, but I think a lot of people felt, and I think it was a tough job for a person in the business office to accommodate himself to, between the students and the faculty and central administration.
The Bureau of the Budget.
Right, and the Bureau of the Budget, right.
That whole evolution of the university,
right,
out of the Procrustean bed of a state department having to do with standards and purchase.
Yeah.
We lost some people because of frustration.
Right. Oh, yeah. No question about it. And of course, the university still fighting that fight.
Yeah.
They didn't get anywhere this last venture, but they maybe made a little progress. But
I think they made some progress.
Yeah, right. They made some progress, but but not anywhere near to the dimension that they had hoped for. But I never really, knowing it's not only the attitude of the governor's office and the budget office, but even in the legislature, they don't want, they're not ready to give the kind of independence in most cases the state universities and other states have a constitutional independence, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course here the university was trying to get a simulated constitutional independence by this creation of a semi-autonomous corporation, kind of like the Research Foundation. And the legislature and the governor are not ready for that.
Which governor are you talking about?
Cuomo.
How was Kerry?
Kerry, well, he's a very different kind of a person than Cuomo.
Did he understand what a university required?
No, he really didn't.
Did Rockefeller?
Probably more so than the others. Yeah, I'd say probably he more so than any of the other governors.
Even Harriman?
Mm-hmm.
Even Harriman?
Oh, Harriman. Oh. He was impossible. Yeah, he just had no use for public higher education. No. No, he was worse than Dewey. I have to give Dewey credit for the fact that he went as far as he did, which was farther than he wanted to go, and he probably wouldn't have gone that far in the legislation if it wasn't for his great antipathy to the regents and the fact that he was running for president in 1948. It was like what Frank Morton was very close to. He said, he had the same attitude towards the state university that he had towards public power. He says, you can't get elected governor of New York State, this is back when he was, and be against public power. That was his political assessment of the situation. So what did he do? He created the power authority, so that all the power that was developed from up in the St. Lawrence River, as well as the power that already had been developed at Niagara, was made available to the power authority, who just transferred it over and to the private power companies. So, and that still is the pattern.
This is Dewey.
That kept public power really in the hands of private power. There was a certain, but that's the way he could do it. He said, we'll keep it under control. We can't really, I don't really want to have full public power, which there was quite a demand for at that time. And he said, so he was representing the private power interests. And of course, they're still represented through the power authority, because they have the control of all the distribution of the power. The state does, and the federal government, of course, has some say about how the power should be allocated, but actually the actual power facilities are owned, and other than the public hydro powers, it's owned by the private, most of it's owned by the private power company. He had that same attitude towards the state university. When Elliot came and asked me if I would go and become the first business officer for the university, John Burton, who was very much involved in all this legislation setting up the state university, much more so even than the governor, in working out the details of it. He said to me, "Oh, geez, don't go to the state university. That's never going to amount to anything." And I said, "Well, I'll take my chances. I'm going to go."
Well, now, why has it come this far?
Well, because I'd say, I'd have to give the greatest amount of credit to Rockefeller. It couldn't possibly have come that far if it hadn't been for Rockefeller. Working out the financing mechanism, backing the university. And I think, on the other hand, the people now have come to a realization that, you know, as costs in higher education in the private sector gets more and more expensive, there's more and more support for public higher education. And of course, the other thing which I was involved in is City University. You know, where would City University be if it wasn't for the state? And when I first came in and with Burton and with Dewey, the first financial aid to the City University was made available by the state. And that was primarily, at that time, just for the support of teacher education.